Kildare Focus with Ciara Plunkett.
You're welcome on into Friday's edition of Kildare Focus. In just a moment, we'll be talking about the fact that effectively nothing has changed in terms of the easing of restrictions on visitation and accompaniment at Ireland's maternity hospitals. I'll hear from Robert Purcell, who's a criminal law solicitor at M.E. Hanahoe Solicitors, about the Justice Minister seeking to extend laws governing the Special Criminal Court. Drink Aware has launched its Safe Summer Socialisation campaign, and Clem and Owen were talking today about biodiversity action plans on this morning's edition of Kildare Today. We'll bring you more on that with Dr. Brian Deegan, Irish Waters Biodiversity and Ecological Assessment Specialist. As always, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with your comments, your requests, your dedications by text or WhatsApp to 0833 97 97 97 studio at kfmradio.com, or you can tweet us at kfmradio if you wish.
All the hits, all the day.
Tens of thousands of people have signed petitions. I don't know how many statements have been made on this matter in the Dáil, at various committees and in the Seanad, and the Chief Medical Officer and others, including the Chief Executive of the HSE, have all said that unless there are specific local issues in place, perhaps to do with the building structure, then restrictions should be eased on accompaniment and certain elements of visitation at maternity hospitals. In the main, that hasn't happened. I'm joined on the line now to discuss this by Creta Lynch. She's chair of the Association for Improvements in Maternity Services Ireland. Creta, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks, Ciara, and such a lovely sunny day. Hope it's nice in Kildare. It's nice where I am, and I think there's a general feeling, isn't there, of things changing, of, you know, the fact that hotels are opening, we're going to have our holidays booked soon, you know, people are going shopping for the first time in 5 months, you know, there are wedding invitations coming. So all of these new things for people to do, it seems like a whole different lifetime because we spent so long not doing them. And of course, babies are still being born, but being born pretty much under the same rules as applied in the absolute height of the pandemic. And that is proving so difficult for so many people. And it's also leading people to just be quite confounded. You know, why? Why is this not changing? Because we're still seeing that people are going into all their antenatal appointments alone. In some hospitals, there seems to be some easing in the sense that you can have perhaps someone with you for a 20-week scan, but that doesn't happen. Not everybody gets a 20-week scan, so for some people that's no change. And then in labour, the things seem to be pretty much the same. So you're going into labour on your own, you're going into the hospital on your own with contractions, or if you're getting an induction, you're going in again on your own. And then partners are still only being brought up quite late in the process and sitting alone outside in car parks. So very, very difficult.
The matter was brought before the Dáil again this week on Wednesday by independent TD Catherine Connolly. I mean, I don't know quite how many people we need to hear speak on this. Stephen Donnelly has made statements. The chief executive of the HSE, Paul Reid, the chief medical officer, Tony Houlihan. And yet we're still in a situation where whilst the Health Minister does say 14 out of Ireland's 19 maternity hospitals are fully compliant with national policy, that nobody has actively changed the national policy. And I can't quite get to why.
Well, I think that it deserves a bit of exploration because what we're seeing is something that we, in essence, had hoped would not happen again. Because we certainly had a situation maybe 10 or 15 years ago where Ireland's maternity hospitals, each hospital was kind of a rule unto itself and acted with respect to rules that individual clinicians or managers made within those individual units. And, you know, sometimes that worked out well, but sometimes it didn't work out so well. And there were some very, very difficult scenarios. And so we have a national maternity strategy to try and ensure that we don't have these situations where you get one thing in one hospital, you don't get it in another, that because you live in a certain place, you can't have access to something. So we're supposed to have complete clear guidance and governance overseen by the HSE, by Paul Reid himself, and then, of course, all of that overseen by Stephen Donnelly. And this seems to be completely not happening with respect to these restrictions. And you know, we're supposed to be getting risk assessments for every single unit, and these are definitely not forthcoming. And I think perhaps one of the things also that I would question is, where did this national guidance in and of itself come from? You know, who even decided that in order to make everybody feel okay, these were the things that were needed? Like, you needed someone at a 20-week scan, that you needed to have a partner all the way through labor, and you needed at least a half an hour visitation. I mean, a half an hour visitation is very, very small for somebody who's just had a baby when they can go and shop in Pennies. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, to be honest, Krisha, the fact that there are those teeny tiny little bending of the rules, if you will, kind of gives the lie to the existence of those regulations in the first place. Either it's safe to have people accompanying pregnant women at various stages of their gestation and labour, or it's not. It can't be both.
I think that you've absolutely hit the nail on the head there. You know, it's either safe to have somebody come up into a postnatal ward and go into a ward where there are another six or seven women, perhaps, who have just given birth, plus their babies, and it's not always singletons. We've lots of twins being born. Big shout out to someone I helped who had twins today.
Oh, lovely.
Big shout out to Una. Well done.
Well done, Una. Congratulations.
So, you know, if that's safe, then why is it not safe for the same partner to have been in an antenatal ward with the labouring person in the early stages of labour? And this is the thing that everybody is coming back to. You know, you have you come up the stairs, you go through the main hospital, you then turn left and you go into the postnatal rooms, and this seems to be enabled. But you can't turn right and go on the other side of the corridor where your partner is in early labour. It doesn't make any sense. And we really need to get some kind of leadership now from Paul Reid and the minister, because, you know, labour, all of your listeners who've had a baby, you all know that once you get into it, you do manage and you do cope. And Ireland has fantastic midwives and doctors to help us. You know, you do that. But the difficult part is right at the very beginning. The hardest part is at the beginning, because you have all these unknowns. If you're not in labour enough, i.e. if you're not 4 or 5 centimetres, you get put on an antenatal ward where there are other people, you're on your own, you don't have access to any pain relief, there's no gas and air there, there's no option of an epidural there, and the midwife in that ward is dealing with 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 people, so there's no one-to-one care either. So if ever there's a time that you need somebody, that's the time you need somebody, and that's the time it can get very worrying, very frightening, and very anxious or anxiety-provoking for the person. So, you know, in order to avoid these traumas later on, I mean, which are so difficult for people with a new baby, it would be so important to have that person with you at that point. Equally, when someone's coming in to hear news that may not be what they were hoping for, so any emergency visits, it should be without any question that if you're coming into an emergency ER visit because you don't have fetal movement or because you have bleeding, you know, that is already, those are red flags, and your partner should absolutely accompany you in those moments, even for nothing else, that the fact that while you're waiting, you can hold their hand.
Yeah.
Even for that.
And I just want to relay the experience of Sinn Féin TD Donna O'Leary, who spoke on this matter in the Dáil and is also quoted in the Journal. He says, just before last Christmas, my partner Emer had an emergency appointment with the early pregnancy unit because she was bleeding. I waited outside in the car park, looking out the window of the early pregnancy unit waiting room. It was as close as I could get. So he was sitting in his car, just staring at the building. I'm glad to say that everything was okay, but we were worried. If it had not been okay, Emer would have had to face the appointment alone. She would have got that bad, devastating, earth-shattering news alone. The situation is still the same today. So it's not just women, it's not just advocates for women who are speaking out, it's fathers and prospective fathers. And we still have a situation where restrictions, which certainly to a layperson, and I readily admit that, don't seem to be particularly rational, stay in effect. And I'm wondering, Krisha, whose needs do these restrictions serve?
Well, you'd have to wonder. I mean, we're certainly getting reports back from people working within maternity units who are saying, well, yeah, you know, it's difficult for people, but, you know, it's great for us because there's less people there, and it's easier for us to get on with our jobs, and it's easier for us to, you know, get women to take certain interventions that they may not take, or they may dither about, or they might have their partners discuss with us, you know, for a long period of time. So there is an element of that. There's a definite element that it enables certain aspects of maternity care to be carried out in a certain way. And some people like that. And that, in and of itself, is very concerning because that doesn't put the woman at the center of her care. You know, that puts care providers' needs at the center of the care.
And I, you know, I'm going to be kind and say, look, I can understand why people value efficiency, but that's not a good enough reason or a sufficient reason to keep these restrictions ongoing as long as they have been. I understand completely why they may have been in effect in the early stages of the pandemic, because not one of us or very few of us had any idea what we were encountering and what we were dealing with. And it would be reasonable at that early stage to be as safe and to put in place as many as restrictions as could reasonably be borne. We're, what, 15 months in now?
Oh, and in quite a different situation. I think everybody was, you know, all of us were absolutely at the beginning, put whatever restrictions, be ultra-conservative, because we didn't really know what we were dealing with. We didn't know the nature of COVID. We didn't know how easily it was transferred. Nobody was vaccinated. I mean, now all of the hospital staff are vaccinated. That's another issue. So why is this not being put into a risk assessment? Surely the fact that people are vaccinated would mean that the risk of transmission, if it were documented and publicly available, would show that the risk of transmission is much, much depreciated due to the fact that all of our healthcare services workers are vaccinated. And, you know, people really can't understand why their needs are not being met. They can't understand why these units are actually saying they're compliant as well when they're obviously not compliant. I mean, one of the things that we've done in Ames is we asked people over the last 2 to 3 weeks, could they come back to us if they wanted to, of course, after they'd had a baby, and could they just say, you know, what was their experience? Did they experience anything different? And people are not experiencing anything different. I'll give you an example, obviously anonymously, of somebody who had a baby in a big maternity unit in the southwest of the country. And she went in to have an induction. She had to go in on her own. Her partner did not accompany her, even though that hospital is allegedly compliant, which means allegedly that a partner should be accompanying her for the induction process. She went through the induction process. She progressed quite quickly. Nobody really cottoned on that she'd progressed that quickly. She was then taken to a labouring room where she was told she was fully dilated and she was starting to have her baby, at which point her partner was called. So the partner only made an appearance really at the very end when the baby was literally being born. And that means you can tick a box and say a partner was there, but did that woman actually get the support that she deserved, that she needed, and she so desperately wanted from her partner? And I would argue she didn't.
Well, Chrétia Lynch, Chair of AIMS, the Association for Improvements in Maternity Services Ireland, thank you again for joining us on this issue, which affects so many people right across the country. If this is something of which you have had experience or a loved one, do let us know. Please do so anonymously if you wish. 0833 97 97 97.
Kildare Focus with Ciara Plunkett.
The government has agreed to extend laws governing the Special Criminal Court. To discuss this, I'm joined now on the line by Solicitor in Criminal Law at ME Hanahoe Solicitors, Robert Purcell. Robert, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara. How are you?
I'm not too bad at all. I know virtually everybody is familiar with the title of this court, the Special Criminal Court, but may not be fully aware of why it's special. Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, OK, that's a good question. Well, under the Constitution, everybody is entitled to a jury trial, except for sort of minor offences, but it also gives the government under Article 38.3 the power to set up statutory courts, which they then did in 1939, and that was the first version of the Special Criminal Court post the 1937 Constitution, and that court existed for a period of time through the emergency and the Second World War, and it was there to deal with what we would call subversive activity. So essentially, as like the piece of legislation that brought into force offences against the state. Then again, as a result of I suppose the increase in tension and incidents that would have occurred in the late 1960s and the early 70s in the north and the border areas, Jack Lynch government at that time re-established the Special Criminal Court through a proclamation made under the Offences Against the State Act, setting up the current version of the Special Criminal Court, and that has remained in place for the last 50 years.
This might seem like quite a silly question, but I hope you'll grant me the indulgence. Why are laws required to extend the Special Criminal Court when no other court in the land is limited by time or the expiration of legislation?
Well, simply because it was a court set up by statute for particular situations. I suppose I don't want to get into the thing of reading the actual legislation, but the legislation that would set it up would have specified that there would be, what we might call temporary emergency legislation being set up in order to establish the non-jury courts to deal with these types of cases. So it's only envisaged to be a temporary thing. Well, sorry, it's argued that it was only envisaged to be a temporary thing rather than something of permanency.
But in fairness, if whomsoever set it up and had that vision of its temporary or fleeting nature at that time, they may have to revise their concept of the temporariness if they were to see it now. If you were to look at it in the grand span of human existence, yes, it's temporary, but in no other perspective.
Well, I would disagree with that. I think if something is set up in special circumstances, I think the fact that it remains in place for 50 years is exceptional rather than something to be necessarily taken as read. There was a review set up in the late 90s, early 2000s that was headed by, retired Judge Anthony Hederman, which recommended that the court be reviewed on a very frequent basis. That hasn't happened. Also in 1974, former President Mary Robinson wrote the first book on the Special Criminal Court, which had been in existence for 2 years at that time and had dealt with quite a number of offences over the course of that 2 years. And indeed, she concluded and recommended at that time that it should be the subject of continuous oversight from both the Oireachtas, and that the discretion to refer offences there by the Attorney General at that time and the DPP in this current era, their discretion should be tempered somewhat in relation to that. So I would say that there are two fairly sizable contributions in relation to the court, and indeed Mr. Justice Hederman himself said that the setting up of courts like this, the continuation of them, is something that has to be revisited because they are, in effect, something that is not something that is preferable in a properly functioning democracy.
And Robert, when next will the government be required, or the government of that relevant day be required, to extend the laws?
Well, they don't have to extend them at the moment because, as of this moment in time, the Constitution itself obviously is set out that the government, any government properly functioning, will be in a position to legislate for special courts. They've done that. The proclamation in 1972 remains in place. I think what's at issue really, Ciara, is that there hasn't been the necessary reviews and assessment of the use of the court and the power to refer cases to the court that a creature of its nature should require. And that really is the point that has been made by obviously the previous judges that have reported on this, Mary Robinson herself, and various commentators throughout the years. Now, at present, some 20 years later, a retired judge, High Court Judge Michael Peart, has been appointed, I think, by the Minister for Justice, Helen McEntee, mm-hmm. to conduct a review. We would just say it's long overdue. And if that review comes with conclusions and recommendations for the government, they should be put before the Oireachtas and properly debated and considered. Well, and that is the right way to go about it. And ultimately, it is a matter for the Oireachtas and the government of the day.
Well, Robert Purcell, criminal law solicitor at Emmy Hanahoe Solicitors and indeed a member of the Law Society's Criminal Law Committee, thank you for joining us. Summer is well and truly here, certainly looking out the door from the radio centre here in the M7 Business Park in Naas. It is a glorious day and long may that continue. But with summer, many of us think of barbecues and, you know, think of sneaky little beers and that extra couple of glasses of wine. DrinkAware is saying that we should enjoy summer, but do it safely and responsibly. I'm joined on the line now by its communications manager, Jennifer Flynn. Jennifer, you're welcome to the programme.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What is it that you want us to do? Enjoy ourselves, but just make sure we're not going overboard.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So DrinkAware, as the national charity working to prevent and reduce the misuse of alcohol, we decided this weekend, with it being the June bank holiday weekend, that we would launch our Safe Summer Socialising campaign. So after a year of lockdowns and the restrictions easing, the weather's improving, so we all know we're going to be outside more. There's pent-up energy from people wanting to celebrate, you know, things that they've missed over the past year. And with that, we know alcohol is invariably a part of social occasions in Ireland. But we want people to be able to socialise safely. And alcohol does lower our inhibitions. So we want people to be mindful of that. So we're offering simple advice and tips. And what I mean by being mindful of your drinking would be how, why, and where, and how much we are drinking. So our campaign covers things like mindful drinking, as I've said. So to use a unit measure, drink plenty of water, eat before you drink. Those kind of things are what we're trying to convey to the public. How, you know, there are laws on outdoor drinking, and be mindful about what those laws are, because they differ from cities and counties. Being COVID responsible, you know, COVID is still a very highly contagious virus. So turn down invites to large gatherings, even though it is hard. You know, we've all missed our family and friends.
And everybody's so eager to meet up.
So eager, and as they should be. And we can safely socialise this summer, and that's what we're trying to get across to people. It's about being kind of responsible, avoiding the crowded areas, wearing your mask, you know, if you are in a crowded area, practicing your social distancing. But also we wanted to talk to people about things like being fun smart. You know, if you're outside having a few drinks, you could get distracted chatting away and forget that you haven't put any sun cream on.
And then go home looking like a lobster with a very sore head.
Exactly. And, you know, the sun is so damaging to our skin. But when you're, you know, having a few drinks and sitting in the sun, you're going to become more dehydrated. So it's those kind of tips we're trying to put across to the public as well. You know, we saw it last weekend, cleaning up after yourself.
Oh, God, yes.
You're trying to stress. You know, bring a bin bag with you. Don't leave your rubbish behind, because it's not fair.
And I know, Jennifer, if you're going to meet up with friends, you know, in a public space, and you thought, oh, I haven't seen them, you know, since last October or whatever it was, you're not going to be thinking, oh, I'll bring an extra bin bag to clean up after myself, because that just seems like far too practical, and you're there to have fun, and nobody likes being practical. But the reality of it is, we don't have enough bins, and you can't just leave your rubbish where it lies.
No, we can't. And as well as that, you know, leaving your rubbish beside a bin is not the same as putting your rubbish in a bin.
As every mother in Ireland will know when they're talking about your dirty clothes and the laundry basket.
Exactly. And, you know, bringing a bin bag with you, it doesn't add any extra weight. If you're able to carry the products that you've purchased to the area that you're going to, you're able to carry them back home with you. Not asking people to do anything, you know, too strenuous. It's just practical advice and tips so that we can all enjoy this summer.
I want to talk to you about something that you touched on there, and arguably most of us need to get back into this habit. And, you know, if you're pouring a measure of drinks at home for yourself in the depths of winter, in the middle of a pandemic, the like of which hasn't been seen for 100 years, you might be a little bit more generous with yourself than you would ordinarily. And you mentioned bringing a unit measure with you. I would say most people, if they're measuring out particularly a spirit at home, are pouring themselves double or triples and not realising it.
Yeah, and that is something that people need to be quite conscious of, especially in terms of, say, getting into the car the next morning. So on the Drinkaware website, drinkaware.ie, we do offer a free measuring cup that you can order online and we'll post it out to you. And it does indicate what the measures are for each type of alcoholic drink. And using a measure just, you know, makes it safer for you and for everybody else because you know how much alcohol you're drinking.
Okay, and as well, there is the other thing of if we have a bank holiday weekend like today, most people might be having a couple of drinks tonight, might be having a couple on Saturday, on Sunday, and they might be day drinking on Monday. As well as limiting what you consume during each time you drink, you should probably limit the occasions on which you drink.
Yeah, of course. So there are the low-risk weekly guidelines as advised by the HSE, and it's important just to say that they're not targets that people should aim to achieve, but they're guidelines. So it's 11 standard drinks for women spread out across the week with 2 alcohol-free days and 17 for men, again, spread out across the week with 2 alcohol-free days. And a standard drink, examples of these would be half a pint, a pub measure of spirits or a 100ml glass of wine. So often people might think, you know, I've had 3 pints, I've had 3 standard drinks.
Yeah.
But you haven't. You've actually had 6. So that's really important for people just to be aware of how much they are drinking. Because if you are free pouring or if you're topping up a glass, say, of wine, you might be drinking a lot more than you even intended to yourself.
Well, Jennifer Flynn, thank you indeed for joining us there on DrinkAware's Safe Summer Socialising campaign. That's Jennifer Flynn, Communications Manager with DrinkAware. Irish Water have launched a biodiversity action plan. It's in a bid to increase the pace of return of rare or threatened species, as well as halting the decline of Ireland's rich biodiversity. I'm joined on the line by Dr. Brian Deegan. He's an Environmental and Ecological Assessment Specialist at Irish Water. Brian, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you for having me.
Delighted to do so. I suppose when most people think of Irish Water, they don't think of biodiversity or, you know, promoting flora and fauna right across the country. What role is Irish Water playing here?
Irish Water, as a public authority, is playing a huge role here. I guess when you look at biodiversity and natural environment, it's fundamental to our business. We take drinking water from natural environment and we return treated wastewater back to the environment. So without a healthy environment, our water services would be in a bad state.
And talk to me about this plan, because Irish Water has land holdings right across the country, both in terms of the lands on which its buildings and infrastructure is physically constructed, but also in their hinterlands. Are you utilising this to try and create the space in which biodiversity can flourish?
That's exactly it. Like, we have over 1,700 water and wastewater treatment plants right across the country from every town and village. We have infrastructure. So it's this plan, as you say, it's our national plan that we will roll out measures in terms of how we manage these sites to both protect, conserve and enhance biodiversity across all of our sites across the country.
Some of these undertakings are really, really significant. In Ballymore Eustace, which is the country's largest water treatment plant, 56 hectares of lands, including wildflower meadows and native woodland. In Kerry, 5.27 hectares of native woodland are being planted at the Loch Quitan water treatment plant. Other measures underway at a 12-hectare Waterford wastewater plant. These are big projects, Brian.
These are very big projects. I'm glad you brought up Loch Quitan. Like, this is our first forestry scheme, which is commencing planting immediately. We're looking at hopefully planting over 300 acres over the next 10 years with native woodland forestry.
And these would be slow-growing but indigenous species of tree to Ireland?
Yeah, that's exactly it. They would be all native species that we would put in place.
And what do you hope then that those copses will attract in terms of animal and bird life?
Well, Kira, in terms of, first of all, you'll have your native species, so you'll get your native insects, your butterflies, your bees, etc. coming back. That will bring in back your bird species. We found a number of sites where we have, returning to these sites, we've got the long-tailed tit. You have pine marten returning to our sites. We have records of otter, etc. returning to our sites. So it's great to see simple measures. We're already seeing the rewards from it.
That's very exciting, particularly such a broad spectrum of species.
that's exactly it. If you get the plants right, the insects, the birds, the mammals, they will all follow in time.
And talk to me then about the span of the Biodiversity Action Plan. We've touched on some, I would imagine, of the keynote projects that would underpin the action plan. But you've said, Brian, you've 1,700 properties around the country. Clearly, projects of that scale won't be possible at them all. But will biodiversity encouragement elements be in place at many more plants?
We would hope to apply measures across every single one of our sites. Like, it's not going to be every measure for every site.
Yeah.
But there's some small things that can be done at every site. Like I mentioned there, we have 1,700 water and wastewater treatment plant sites. But we have many more smaller sites, which would be for the likes of pump stations, etc. What we can do is we can manage those for pollinators. So that's why we've already made a commitment with the National Biodiversity Database, and we've signed up as a key partner to the new pollinator plan. So we can manage it for pollinators.
And I suppose your actions will be site-specific, dependent upon the lands available at the site and the surrounding environment. And they could range from something as simple as allowing a wildflower meadow to flourish there, up to those really high-level, ambitious projects like you have at Loch Cuitan.
That's exactly it. So, as I said, no site is too small. So a small half-acre site, we can do something there. But likewise, we're doing stuff up at Ballymore Eustis, which is over 56 hectare site. So it's across all of our ranger sites, from the smallest up to the largest. We can put different measures in place.
It's certainly very, very exciting. And how long does this plan run for, Brian?
This is a five-year plan, which will be reviewed and updated after that five-year period. So this is an enduring plan. It will be going on forevermore.
Well, Dr. Brian Deegan, Environmental and Ecological Assessment Specialist at Irish Water, thank you indeed for joining us this afternoon. Don't forget that we have a full spectrum and a full menu of sports reportage available here on KFM Radio across the weekend, including Saturday and Sunday with both of our Sports Beats programme and throughout the afternoon in our sports coverage. There's also a full round of sports programmes available on Monday afternoon. Irish boxers are in action as well at the European Olympic qualifiers in Paris. Already one win noted for Aoife O'Rourke. She's now one win away from a place at Tokyo 2020. Kenny Harrington, former world champion, is in the ring at about quarter to seven Irish time. My thanks to you all for your company today. My thanks to Kildare Focus producer today, which was Owen Beattie.